case today is the National Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus CSX. Ms. Pave?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am here on behalf of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. The IBEW is a party that was made to arbitrate a dispute before a neutral selected by its adversaries, before a board made up of partisan members representing each of its adversaries, while it was forbidden to have anyone represent the interests of itself and the employees he represents on the board.
It's not really an adversary of CSX. You're both looking for the same result. They got a little different theory than you have, but they're basically on your side, aren't they?
Actually, Judge Cudahy, they were not on our side. Our position was that we had the exclusive right to do this work. CSXT completely...
Well, they said it was discretionary, I guess, for them. But, I mean, the result, this involved some pay for a worker that you claim should have been a member of the union. That's the bottom line. And we both were arguing for the same bottom line, I think.
With all due respect, we weren't, Your Honor. We were arguing for a bottom line that said this work can be done solely by IBEW-represented employees. CXXT's bottom line was this can be done by whoever we wish to give it to, whether it be a BRS employee or an IBEW employee.
Well, that's the difference in theory. It doesn't change the bottom line. But go ahead with your argument.
Okay, Your Honor. There is no dispute here that IBEW was not permitted to be party to the agreement that created the board that would decide the dispute, was not permitted to have a partisan member on that board, therefore was not allowed to participate in debate regarding the final decision of the award. There is also no dispute that IBEW did not consent to have this dispute in which it was fully interested, decided by a board created by its adversaries in which it had no role. It is our position that this board cannot bind IBEW under those circumstances.
How about the TCU case?
The TCU case addressed the National Railroad Adjustment Board. It was decided by the Supreme Court in regards to a case that came out of the NRAB. That decision does not require that the IBEW be limited to third-party status in Section 3, second paragraph board proceedings. TCU did not speak to such proceedings. And indeed, the procedures of Section 3, second paragraph boards are distinct from the procedures and requirements of the NRAB. And moreover, the legislative history behind the creation of these second paragraph boards demonstrates that they were intended to be like first paragraph boards, not like the NRAB. And again, that legislative history makes it clear that the boards created under the first paragraph of Section 3, second, throughout their long existence, did not decide cases where two unions claimed jurisdiction over the work and one of those unions did not consent. Indeed, I believe the testimony from the carrier representatives was that there had been something like 609 of these boards that had decided tens of thousands of cases, and these boards under Section 3, second, first paragraph, on which the second paragraph PLB boards are fashioned, did not decide these sorts of jurisdictional disputes.
We relied on subpart J, didn't we?
Yes, Your Honor. Section 3, first.
You claim that that shouldn't apply to this kind of board, I guess.
Not in the sense of they are a non-consenting union, a union who has as much interest in the matter as the other union and the carrier are involved, and where that union, in this case IBEW, does not consent to have the decision made by its adversary union and the carrier. Again, as I said, it's notable that boards created under the second paragraph of Section 3, second, call POBs or SBAs under the second paragraph, have very different procedures in the statute than the statutory procedures established for the National Railroad Adjustment Board. For example, under Section 3, First I, the NRAB cannot take jurisdiction of a claim unless it has been handled on the property up to the highest designated officer. POB agreements created under Section 3, second paragraph often allow the board to consider cases that have not been so handled. Similarly, Section 3, First F of the NRAB provides for the neutral of the NRAB to be selected by the NMB. POB agreements provide for selection by the parties. Again, Section 3, First V requires that the NRAB create rules to control the procedures before it. For PLBs, the rules controlling the procedures are created by the parties to the PLB agreement because the PLBs, these alternative boards, are private arbitral boards. And in that sense, one of the keys to such boards is the ability to select the neutral. I mean, plainly, if you have an interest in a matter, and you have two adversaries who have different interests than you do, plainly, it is in your interest and the interest of those you represent to have the same role in deciding who will sit on that board as your adversaries do. In this case,
seems to me that if you're asking for the same relief as CSX, you've got a 2-to-1 situation if you get on this board as well as they.
Well, we would say that...
You don't concede that you have any encounter with the CSX, then?
No, we don't, Your Honor.
Well, let's assume that you do. In this kind of a case, there could very well be parallel interests involved.
But indeed, in those situations, and I believe that those many of these are the situations referred to in the carrier's brief, where, in fact, union B's interests are aligned with the carrier, where the carrier says, this belongs solely to union B, and union A brings a claim saying, no, it belongs to us. In that situation, union B will often consent to a bipartite board, in a sense, just two parties, because their interests, the interests of union B and its membership, really are represented by the carrier. But this was not that case. This was a case where CSXT's position was, we can give it to whichever type of employee we wish. BRS's position was, no, you've got to give it to our employees. IBW's position, in contradistinction to either of those two parties, was, you've got to give it to IBEW employees.
And there are an unlimited number of unions, I suppose, and representatives on the board. The electoral workers are found in a number of other unions, I guess the UE and the IUE, and I don't think they have to take business away from the city one, but theoretically, we should have a lot of unions here involved. And would be your position we all ought to have a representative on the board?
I'm not sure I exactly understand your question, but in a situation, if the work in this case had been given, I don't know, to a machinist instead of a signalman, although I can't see how that would happen, but let's say it had, IBEW would not be, the IBEW contract would not be interpreted by the deciding board, so IBEW would not have a basis for asserting that it needed to participate in the creation of the board, the selection of the neutral, and be a member in the executive sessions and the deliberations.
In principle, though, what you're saying, there's no limitation on the number of people you can have on a board, assuming you all have an interest in the matter, which... You're saying in the hypothetical, I propose that IBEW wouldn't have an interest, which may be the case, but in principle, if you follow your logic, it seems to me we've got to put something on the board for every union that claims an interest, don't we?
Well, but again, I think part of the key to claiming an interest is, and it is undisputed, that the IBEW contract was interpreted by this board in arriving at its decision. So when one says when we say that IBEW had an interest, it's not a sort of vague, generalized, gee, we care about it sort of interest, but a very specific, this is our contract. And indeed, this contract is distinct from the BRS contract. The BRS partisan has no experience in the past practice interpretation and application of the IBEW contract. An IBEW partisan who had would, in our view, be required to sit on the board because we had so requested, would have that ability. And as this court and many others have recognized, when interpreting contracts, it's important to understand how those contracts are applied, what the words really mean in practice. And again, here, the neutral was deprived of the opportunity to have a partisan of IBEW with that knowledge on the board and able to educate him about the true meaning of the IBEW provisions at issue. If your honors will permit me, I will reserve the rest of my rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
I'm here for the railroad. One thing I noticed from listening to the argument this morning is so far there's been no discussion of what controls this case. That is the statute. The IBEW is complaining about the composition of the board, but the statute dictates the composition of the board. The statute says that a public law board will consist of one member appointed by the carrier, one member appointed by the union who filed the grievance, and if they cannot agree on the disposition of the matter, then a neutral selected by the two of them. Three members on the board. The statute is clear. The IBEW never wants to talk about the statute. They have no answer for how the PLB here violated the Railway Labor Act. As the district court noticed in its decision, the IBEW never identifies any provision in the Railway Labor Act that the PLB supposedly violated.
They do refer to an Eighth Circuit opinions, however.
Yes, they do. And those cases are just flat out wrong, Your Honor, and that's why no one follows them. And with all due respect to the Eighth Circuit, we discuss those in our briefs. The district court goes over them there, and there the Eighth Circuit recognized in Union Pacific versus, I'm sorry, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers versus Union Pacific, they recognized that their decision was contrary to the statute. They said the statute says three, and if we were writing on a clean slate, we would uphold this public law board award, but they interpreted two of their prior precedents to require that both unions have full participation in a public law board setting. Now, neither of those precedents, however, involved the issues here. The first award, the first decision being one, that involved the situation of which union could sit on the board. B and two didn't involve a three-way dispute. Frankly, the Eighth Circuit misread its precedents, and it recognizes that the statute requires three. Now, on appeal, the union has raised a new argument. Their new argument that they did not present to the district court is that only the National Railroad Adjustment Board has jurisdiction over three-way disputes like this. But again, they're ignoring the statute, because in Section 3, second paragraph, which defines the jurisdiction and reach of public law boards, it says that POBs can be established to resolve disputes otherwise referable to the National Railroad Adjustment Board. So IBEW concedes that the NRAB could have heard this dispute. The statute says that any dispute the NRAB can hear, public law boards can hear as well. Now, one other new argument that they raise in their appellate brief, they raise this argument in the district court. They didn't talk about it in their opening brief. They saved it for their reply brief, so we didn't get a chance to respond to it in our appellate brief. Is another problem we never deal with is the problem of a deadlock. What Congress was concerned about in setting up these arbitration mechanisms is you not have deadlocks. So that's why you have three members of a public law board. But if you have four members, like they argue for, you obviously have the opportunity for deadlocks. And they argue that this can be resolved, that there can be four-member public law boards by pointing to an arbitration agreement that the railroads and two unions agreed to create a special board of adjustment, SBA 1141. And they spend a good deal of time talking about this in their reply appellate brief. The short answer to that, Your Honors, is that that was not a public law board. It doesn't say it was a public law board. It was created under the first unnumbered paragraph of Section 3, second. And by agreement, the parties can agree to any number of members on a arbitration panel. Another thing they don't address, Your Honors, is the precedence of this court. This court has already described the workings of the Public Law Board and has recognized that they only have three members. And again, the IBW doesn't address the Seventh Circuit's precedence in its brief. One such case that we cite is Merchants Dispatch Transportation Corporation, which is 551 F. 2nd 144. And on page 150, this court states, a public law board must consist of two members with impasse to be resolved by a temporary third member chosen by the National Mediation Board. And that would be part of my answer to the Eighth Circuit precedence, besides the fact that the Eighth Circuit got it wrong. This court got it right and recognizes what the statute says. Three means three. Maybe what the IBW is trying to do here, they want to avoid talking about the statute because the statute dictated how Public Law Board 6525 would be conducted. It dictated who the members would be. It dictated how the mutual would be selected. It dictated how the hearings would be held. It dictated that notice would be given to interested third parties, which is what happened here. And again, this is another precedent of this court that the IBW doesn't address. As Judge Kedahy recognized, that it's Section 3-1J, the notice provision for the National Road Adjustment Board, that's the statutory provision which brings in other unions. And that's the statutory provision that the Supreme Court was interpreting in Transportation Communications Employees Union versus Union Pacific. It was there that the Supreme Court said, you have to resolve this dispute in one proceeding. And you do that by getting notice to third parties. They either come in or they don't come in. But they're going to be bound by the result in that particular case. This court, in its decision in O'Neill versus Public Law Board, held that Section 3J applies to public law boards. They, too, have to give notice to interested third parties, and that is what happened here. Maybe what the IBW is trying to do here is evoke some sort of visceral reaction from the court that they were treated unfairly here, but they were not treated unfairly. They were treated the same way unions have been treated since 1966 in these types of disputes. And we showed in the attachment to our brief, and we presented this to the district court as well, we went back and reviewed that there were approximately, as near as we could find, more than 50 three-way disputes decided by public law boards since 1966. And in nine of these, the IBW participated either as a member of the public law board or as a third-party interest. And they didn't have any problem with that until this particular case when they lost the arbitration award. They know under the narrow standard of review of arbitration awards that they can't reverse the award, so they're just looking for a hook to try and reverse it. But it just isn't here, because here the public law board followed the act, and there was no unfairness in the way the IBW was treated. I might mention real quickly that even though they're bound by the result in this particular arbitration, it's only for what happened on that particular day when that particular data radio was replaced by a signalman. They're free to re-arbitrate this issue again in the future when this issue comes up. And it will come up again. There are at least 20 grievances working their way through the process at CSXT involving this very issue. So they will get the opportunity to re-arbitrate this again. In fact, a board will be set up, as we talk in our brief, where the IBW and CSXT will set up a board to arbitrate a similar issue. So there's been no unfairness here. The statute was complied with, and the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Bill Phillips, General Counsel of the Velvet Railroad Signalman. And we all should not lose sight of the fact that we are talking about dispute resolution here, that Congress recognized 80 years ago that the railroad industry needed an expeditious dispute resolution process, and there was a bargain made in the early 1930s that the unions would give up the right to strike over contract grievances in exchange for this system of taxpayer-funded expeditious arbitration. 40 years later, as we know from the legislative history of the 1966 amendments, Congress saw that there was a backlog, that there was not expeditious resolution, and they gave the parties the option to go to three-member public law boards. Subsequent decisions in this court, before and after, not only O'Neill says that the procedural requirements of Section 3 first apply to public law boards under the second paragraph of 3 second, but this court recognized in 1930s that notice and an opportunity to participate was required by Section 3, First J. And, Your Honor, to address your question, the record reflects that on CSXT, communications workers in some territories are represented by the IBEW, and in other territories by the Signalman, and in other territories by the TCU. It's entirely possible that the railroad might take some kind of system-wide action where all three unions might have a grievance. So now maybe we're talking about three neutrals and three unions and the carrier, so we now have a seven-member board. Brother Johnson described how the common law of the shop evolves in the railroad industry. This involves just the changing out of one unit in Roanoke, Alabama, and it appears that there were other units changed out either by signalmen or electricians, communications workers, that the other union is grieving. And if those go to a public law board, the organization that represented the worker that actually did the work will be a third party. And eventually, one side or the other will give up, or there'll be a string of very persuasive awards, and it'll be clear what the law of the shop is with respect to this change in technology. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about, as in the TCU case back in 1966, we're talking about a change of technology that introduced a new type of equipment, and as has been the case between IBEW and the railroad signalmen for more than 80 years, there are jurisdictional disputes over this new technology. Well, this is what Congress created to resolve these kinds of disputes, and it's audacious and baseless to suggest that this court should substitute its judgment and rewrite and ignore the statute. The Eighth Circuit decisions are, I would call them, Your Honor, a mutation. There's the BN1 decision, which talks about the right to participate. Well, we don't dispute that. In the second case, the BN case, the DNA starts getting a little funky because you have a suggestion that one union is entitled to put a member on the board to interpret the collective bargaining agreement of another union. And then you get to the Union Pacific case, which is just flat out wrong. It's just by misinterpreting their own circuit precedent, they lead to a conclusion that violates the statute. You know, in the law as in evolution, sometimes mutations just need to be left alone and not go anywhere.
If we follow the Eighth Circuit of that decision, would we be overturning our existing precedent, do you think?
I think you would, in that the O'Neill case requires that the procedural requirements of Section 3 first will apply to public law boards. You have the requirement of notice and an opportunity to participate to a third party, and that's enough. Let's not lose sight of the fact that there hasn't been any prejudice. There's nothing in the record to suggest that IBEW was prejudiced. The electrician was paid for his work. We can infer that from the record. The electrician was paid. No pay was taken away from an electrician. And nor was the signalman paid as in the award. The panel decided that there would not be an award of pay to the signalman. And we'll move on from here. The other cases will percolate through the system, and eventually this three-way dispute will be resolved. The consent issue was not raised below, and you know you don't have to give consent to arbitrate. It's compulsory in this industry. The courts keep telling us that. The unions keep trying to get around it and get the right to strike, but we're constantly being told that arbitration is mandatory, and it certainly is. And so there's nothing unusual about a union going to arbitration and really not wanting to. Another point I want to make is that the only cases that we get to connect the dots between Section 3 second and Section 3 first, the only cases that can be referred to a PLB are those that are otherwise referable to to the NRAB. So these are cases that are in the posture of potentially being sent to the NRAB, and we know from the record that the NRAB has third-party procedures that are identical to the ones that were followed by this PLB. The parties can refer cases that have been languishing at the NRAB for more than a year and pull them into a PLB. So these are the same kinds of disputes, and there's no reason why the third-party practice that has been followed since the very first PLB shouldn't be followed in this case. And so it's important for the court to not to follow the argument of IBEW that somehow commercial arbitration procedures and even labor procedures from other industries should be incorporated into the into this process. The Congress has prescribed what the procedures are in the Railway Labor Act, a three-member board. TCU case required that this board resolve the dispute, and that's what it did. It resolved the dispute. It said that the Silverman crack should have changed out of this MCP unit in Roanoke, Alabama. I'll close by pointing out that IBEW submitted argument and evidence. I understand that the number of pages it submitted to the PLB exceeded those of the BRS and the carrier combined. They participated in oral argument. They were copied with the draft award before the award became final. And they have never claimed that Arbitrator Vaughan was impartial. In fact, Arbitrator Vaughan did his job. He interpreted both agreements. He resolved the dispute. And the court should confirm the award. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Ms. Pave? You have 6 minutes, Ms. Pave.
Thank you, Your Honor. First and foremost, to answer your question, Judge Kaney, if this court follows the precedent set by the Eighth Circuit, you would not be overruling Seventh Circuit precedent. The question that is before this court has never before been before the Seventh Circuit. Okay. O'Neill involved an individual employee whose union, the UTU, was a party to the PLB agreement, sat as a partisan on the board. Moreover, that individual employee had authorized UTU to represent him. That is not the situation here, just as it was not the situation before the Eighth Circuit. The situation here is the PLB was created by a separate union and the carrier. IBEW did not at any point consent to have either the carrier or that other union represent its interests and that of its employees. To the contrary,
the Eighth Circuit was discomforted by its decision, apparently because it really didn't comply with the statute. Would you want this court to be discomforted as well?
Well, Your Honor, it is our view that in fact...
No, about the decision where a court said, well, we're just... This is where we come out, but we're discomforted by the whole thing. It's not really very persuasive, is it?
Well, but I don't believe, Your Honor, that the court need to have felt discomforted, nor does this court need to so feel. It is apparent that that in this situation where IBEW did not consent to participate in this arbitral process, its due process rights were violated. And this court has recognized that where due process rights are violated, the decision under the RLA is to be voided. Therefore, these various due process rights are in fact recognized by this court as part and parcel of the RLA. So indeed, I don't believe it's discomforting. Indeed, it is notable
due process right to be represented on an arbitration board?
I believe, if I understand your question correctly, Judge Cudahy,
What's at issue here is whether a union that has not consented to this particular form of arbitration, has not participated in selecting the arbitrator, has not participated in the deliberations, can be bound by this decision. Now, the carrier indicates that the POE language requires it. Well, first of all, I have to point out that when it was in their interests, they consider the Eighth Circuit's position to be absolutely correct. And indeed, I want to point out that in their submission, which is Exhibit B to our reply brief, contrary to what they say here, CSXT in that remote control case specifically cited Section 3, 7, second paragraph as the basis for the creation of the board that was at issue there. In other words, it was a PLB, just like the one here, and at that point, they argued vociferously that the Eighth Circuit got it right. And they were right. The Eighth Circuit did get it right.
I'm still unclear about your position. I mean, you just seem to be arguing that disputes of this sort, which implicate the interests of more than one union, can only be arbitrated by the National Adjustment Board, and on the other hand, you're arguing that they can be arbitrated by a local PLB, but only if the third party union gets a seat on the arbitration panel, or increasing its numbers to four, or potentially more if there are more than two unions.
Or consents, as has been often, a union will not feel the need to participate because its interests are represented.
I'm asking for a clarification of your position. Which is it, that all of the disputes of this sort must go to the national board, or that they can be heard by the local board under some circumstances, provided they get a seat at the table?
They can either go to the National Railroad Adjustment Board, they can go to a Section 3, second first paragraph SBA, and they can also go to a Section 3, second paragraph, Section 3, second paragraph, the PLBs, if either the union consents, the second union consents to the decision being made without its participating in the creation of the board, or if it insists on it with that right given to it.
But that requires the reading into the statute of the position that you're advocating, which is that they have to consent or they get to name a member of the arbitration panel, increasing its number beyond the three that is specified in the statute.
Well, again, since as a matter of legislative history, the Section 3, second paragraph boards were not intended to decide a case like this where there was a jurisdictional dispute and a union did not consent to it. We don't believe we are reading anything into it. What is our position is that these disputes can be decided by the NRAB, and they can be decided by a Section 3, second, first paragraph board, and they can be decided by a Section 3, second paragraph board. But in order for the due process rights recognized by this court to be upheld in the RLA, if the latter is chosen, it can only be chosen with the consent of the other involved union. And again, that consent can be, fine, go ahead and do it with two, or it can be, if you're going to choose this way, we need to be a participant. Otherwise, take it to the NRAB, the government-run entity. And that is our position.
Thank you, Ms. Davis.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. We take it under advisement.